Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're not out of the woods yet of the great crash and bailouts of our time, of the losses and disillusionment and horror at the grand-scale depredations of Wall Street. We're still writing and rewriting that history. But back when Lehman Brothers and Bernie Madoff and the other titans were still standing, Adam Haislid was putting the finishing touches on a debut novel about the inner life of an all-too-up-to-date American banker and his world, our world. He just may have nailed it. This hour on Point, Adam Haislid and his new tale of our times, Union Atlantic. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to see what fiction makes of the ugly facts of the last few years of indulgence and collapse? Are you ready for a new bonfire of the vanities? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Adam Haislid joins us in a moment. Before we dig into the book, let's catch up with the real Wall Street banker's story we're still in the middle of right now. I'm joined by David Kirkpatrick in Washington. He covers money and politics for the New York Times. David, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
You had a big story just recently on how Wall Street money, bankers' money, is shifting from the Democrats to the Republicans. How much and why?
Well, how much really remains to be seen. Right now, it's on the level of threat. But people on Wall Street and their lobbyists in Washington are saying to Democratic fundraisers in no uncertain terms, if you keep this up, if you keep coming after us, so to speak, we're going to take our money elsewhere. We've been big sources of financial support for the Democratic Party for a while, especially in 2008 around President Barack Obama, who we thought was a moderate, who really understood our world. And now it sounds like he's joining those crowds with pitchforks coming after us. That's their take, and they're warning that it would translate into a shift in money. But it's really about the psychology of those people in lower Manhattan.
Give us a couple of examples, David, of who and what institutions may be swinging a little bit away from the Democrats here.
Well, the one that caught my eye is J.P. Morgan Chase, which is one of the biggest banks, one of the biggest investment banks. And their political action committee sent a kind of pointed message to the Democrats. Their chief executive is a friend of Obama from Chicago, Jamie Dimon, their chief executive. Their vice chairman is an extremely well-connected Chicago Democrat named Daley, part of the Daley family that runs Chicago.
That's a name we've heard of in Chicago.
Yeah, right. They're very well-connected to the Democratic Party. If there is a firm on Wall Street with Democratic connections, that's it. And this year, they sent a message by giving only to the Republican re-election committees for the House and the Senate, and not they gave $30,000 to the Republican House and Senate re-elect committees and none to their Democratic rivals. And everybody in Washington has noticed. A lot of Republicans are now beating a path to Wall Street, I mean, to try to capitalize on what they say is a kind of buyer's remorse over the election of Obama. So that's one example of the way this signal is being set. But if you talk to people who are big Democratic fundraisers, you really hear quite an earful, often off the record, you know, that they're people who work on Wall Street and have been soliciting donations for Obama and the Democrats are besieged by a kind of "I told you so" from their Republican friends and Democrats who gave them money, saying, "I want my money back. You know, this is not what I bargained for." These people have turned on us.
You remind us of Robert Wolf, who's head of the American division of the Swiss bank UBS. He played golf with President Obama, had lunch there, watched the July 4th fireworks with the president. And now UBS's political action committee, you're reporting, has shifted its contributions. Its biggest contributions went to five Republican opponents of the president's regulatory proposals, including Senator Richard Shelby, ranking member on the minority member on the banking committee.
That's right, and he is the number one biggest obstacle to everything the president wants to accomplish. Robert Wolf is in the most interesting position because he is very close to the president. As you say, watch the fireworks with him and golf with him. The president even put him on his advisory panel to look into solutions to the economic meltdown, and that's the panel that has come up with the proposal that Wall Street finds most onerous, which is to stop Wall Street firms from trading for their own account, from taking big risks, speculative
risks. It's called proprietary trading.
Proprietary trading, exactly so. And Mr. Wolf was on the panel that cooked that up, and he turns out to have been on that panel basically the leading or only opponent to that suggestion. So here he is, friends with the president, put by the president on this panel, and then in that room sort of using his personal status and influence to try to say, oh, no, this ban on proprietary trading is nonsense. We don't need that. And in the end, really just recently, rather late in the process of this regulatory overhaul, which has been going on for 18 months, the president came around and embraced that idea, the ban on proprietary trading.
This was after Scott Brown was elected in Massachusetts, and with Paul Volcker still sitting there. Paul Volcker, a little bit difficult to oppose, maybe. What was your sense in talking to the bankers on Wall Street, David? Do you have a sense of them as being chastened? Are they ready for some more regulation, or are they just going to fight up and down, tooth and nail?
Well, we can all really understand this. They feel quite firmly responsible for their financial success and their employer's financial success, and they don't feel very responsible for the losses that the rest of us have sustained. So people out in the country feel like, well, Wall Street screwed up, and the whole economy went into the gutter. Mm-hmm. We all lost value on our houses. The government had to buy up trillions of dollars in mortgages. Somebody's got to pay the price.
And we bailed them out.
That way at all.
Even with the bailout?
Well, here's what they say to the bailout. They say, well, look, we were forced, many of these firms, we were forced to take this money from the so-called TARP fund, and we've paid it back. We've paid it back with interest. Now, you might say, well, the TARP fund is not at all the measure of the damage that was caused to the federal government and our economy because of this crisis. But if you work on Wall Street, you think, look, hey, that debt was paid. We paid back with interest. We're done. We're moving on, and it's time to collect our bonuses once again. So that's the fundamental disconnect.
Doesn't exactly sound like a cultural revolution.
Yeah.
Not now, not yet, maybe not ever. David Kirkpatrick covers money and politics for the New York Times. David, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Joining me now from New York is Adam Haislett, author of the new novel, Union Atlantic. He started out to be a lawyer with a law degree from Yale, went on to be a writer. His 2002 collection of short stories, You Are Not a Stranger Here, was a finalist for the 2002 National Book Award and for the Pulitzer Prize. The Washington Post calls his new book, his first novel, Union Atlantic, a strange and elegant story that illuminates the financial and moral calamity of the young 21st century. The Wall Street Journal calls it the first serious fictional portrait of the bailout era. Adam Haislett, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you with us. And joining us as well from Hanover, New Hampshire, is our own Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly, and author himself of Age of Betrayal, The Triumph of Money in America, 1865 to 1900, another era. Jack Beatty, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tom, and hello, Adam.
Hello, Jack.
So here you are, and you're kind of the first one to wade in to this round of, I'm not sure what to call it, but it's been our own sort of bonfire of the vanities era. And you clearly must have started writing this, though, before it all came down. What alerted your writer's nose that this was the stuff to get into?
Well, I started the book about 5 years ago, and I guess as a fiction writer, I think of my task as trying to understand the world I'm living in. And as we all know now, that's a world where people who we've never heard of make decisions about highly complex financial transactions, and they can result in, your neighbor losing her job. So that's a world I wanted to understand, not just technically, but also the texture of it, the feelings, the psychology, and the society that bred that whole system.
You've got some amazing characters here. Of course, right at the heart of it is a banker, Doug Fanning. The whole story starts out with him in the Navy, kind of having run away from home, run away from a mother he'd sort of fallen out with. He's in the Persian Gulf, and he's on the U.S. Vincennes that brought down, if we can all turn our minds back to that history, brought down an Iranian civilian airliner, of all things. And he had some sort of moral decisions to make in the heat of that moment that the thing came down, whether to raise objections, whether to talk back. He didn't. He was in on it. He was part of it, as you portray it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an ambiguous moment where he thinks that he might be about to die, but he also senses that they're about to make a grave mistake and kill innocent people, and he saves himself. And my task in that scene and in the rest of the book is always to put the reader right over the shoulder of the character, and so not so much to judge them as to put the reader right there with them, and so they can see it as it unfolds.
You flash forward, 15 years or so, and he's still looking out for number one, but now he's in the financial world.
Yeah, he's a young banker who's climbed quickly up the ladder at Union Atlantic, and now finds himself confronting a neighbor who is objecting to him having built an enormous house.
Enormous, vast, like just incredible. He denuded the hill of trees, the land that had been once been her family, and he built the biggest McMansion, at least in my mind's eye, I've ever heard of.
Yeah, well, this is one of the conflicts that the novel pivots on, is the struggle between what he's done and this retired school teacher whose dogs have begun to speak to her mind is sort of decaying. And
Charlotte Graves with her dogs who speak in the voices of Malcolm X and Cotton Mather, of all things.
That's right. The sort of unconscious of the American liberal tradition.
Jack, we've got the banker, late 30s. He's put in charge of special planning, I think it's called. That's right out on the fringe where American banks got in big trouble in the last decade, Jack.
It sure is. And, you know, this is the first novel, to my knowledge, whose financial and moral gravity is really set by what you could call it Larry Summers' world, because Union Atlantic is a bank and Union Securities is its investment arm. Mm. And thanks to Larry Summers, he called the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which was the act in the Depression that separated investment banks from commercial banks. During the Clinton administration, getting rid of that was one of Larry's proudest achievements. That and the deregulation of derivatives. Now, of course, both of those decisions have helped to put the curse on our own time. And I think in this novel, Adam nicely shows how the repeal of Glass-Steagall maybe wasn't such a great idea.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the first big novel about this turn of the century's Wall Street banking skullduggery. It's called Union Atlantic. Adam Haislett is with us. It's his first novel. He was a finalist for the National Book Award and Pulitzer Prize for his collection of short stories, You Are Not a Stranger Here, in 2002. Now he's out with a book that is very, very much of our times. He joins us from New York. You can join the conversation. Are you ready for a new Bonfire of the Vanities, a novel to nail the greed and off-the-rails ambition of our time? Can fiction match the facts of what we've just witnessed, from Enron to Madoff to the bailout of the billionaires? You can join us at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Adam Haislett, I wonder if you'd read just a little to begin to give us a flavor of what you've put together here. There's a bit where Charlotte Graves, and this is the aging school teacher who's living in a very run-down little house on the hill next to the great Greek Revival chateau that's just been put up, the Super McMansion, is looking out on the mansion and looking out on what's happening to life all around her in the age of the sort of well-heeled bankers that cruise by her in this leafy suburb of Boston. Could you read a bit for us, Adam?
Sure. This is her describing the house. This is what had replaced the woods that Charlotte's grandfather had given to the town for preservation, this steroidal offense. Over the last year, as it was being built, she had often reminded herself that the house was merely the furthest and most galling advance of the much larger intrusion, the one that had begun decades ago, first at a distance, a sighting here or there, a fancy stroller in the library stacks, a concern for caloric totals voiced over the meat counter. More recently had come the giant cars, the ones that looked as if they should have gun turrets mounted on their roofs, manned by the children glaring from the back seat. For years, the news had made so much of bombings in the Middle East, and of course in dear old New York as well, and of the birds of prey we released in retaliation. But they never mentioned the eyes of the wealthy young and the violence simmering numbly there. She had seen it at school, the way her students had grown pointed, turned into swords wielded by their masters.
Yeah, and she doesn't like that world. And, of course, the twist in the plot that turns out to be that it's her younger brother who is the head of the New York Fed, the job Tim Geithner used to have, and he gets called on for some very similar kind of save-the-banks stuff in the middle of the night. Where did you get your education in sort of the back rooms banking world that has brought us so much, Will Adam?
Well, I was interested in the anonymous power that the Federal Reserve wields over much of the economy, which is something that we now, of course, see in the headlines every day, but that's been going on for, you know, ages. And I wanted to get into the psychology of that kind of power. What were the minds and the emotions of the people who were making these abstract decisions? And so I mainly read a lot about it. I talked to people at the Fed. I read about various previous crises. And I just began to imagine my way into that world.
Maybe you'd read just a little more for us. Take us in. This is where your banker, Doug Fanning, who's in charge of special planning, which means basically figuring out how to neatly break the law and make a lot of money, as I read you anyway. He's up in the Union Atlantic, executive suite with the head of the whole bank, Jeffrey Holland. And they're talking about banking and changes in law that they are aggressively anticipating, and politicians and influence. And you just get a kind of inside sense, at least your take, on what that feels and sounds like.
Doug listening to his boss, lobbying Senator Grassley, if that's the passage you're referring
yes,
to.
Yes.
So Jeffrey Holland, who's the head of the bank, is a kind of a large, kind of Bill Clinton-like guy, very persuasive. Mm. And Doug is sitting there listening to him lobby Senator Grassley on the phone. Doug had seen it 100 times, the way he rolled in on a mark, client or politician or friend, leveling their defenses at the outset with the big handshake, the big knowing smile, the slightly colder stare, pushing the last barrier aside, so that by the time he opened his mouth, his target was already nodding in agreement. "Well," Holland said to the senator with a chuckle, "if Bob Rubin can call himself a Democrat, I guess I can too. And believe me, we're talking to your colleagues. No reason this should be a party line matter. The public needs to hear about the safeguards, see how it would make credit cheaper for everyone in the end. We're ready to roll all that out. It's just a matter of timing, which is why I wanted to get your sense of where things stand. Of course, we'll be in touch." Holland removed his earpiece, took a seat, and swung his feet up onto his desk. "Grassley's a snake," he said. "He's still with us, right?" Doug asked. "Sure he is. The bankruptcy bill's been his for years. Trouble is, if it ever gets passed, he'll need a whole new fundraising strategy."
Adam Hazlett reading from his new novel, Union Atlantic. And Grassley would need a whole new fundraising strategy because it's leaning on the bankers who want it passed that's brought him the gold for so long. Jack Beatty, there we are, kind of in Adam Hazlett's imagination anyway, inside the world that we know has been very, very, very active for a long time in shaping the legislative reality of our country.
Indeed. And my one reservation about the time you set this, Adam, is why set it in 2002, 2003, before the harm from these market machinations came due, before the whole architecture of confidence came crashing down, burying the American dream for millions of people? I mean, I don't see the suffering in this novel. I know it's happening, and I know it's happening in America today. But,
sure.
But why did you put it back then rather than now?
Well, the simple answer is I actually finished the book in September 2008, the week that Lehman Brothers collapsed. So I was writing it before the crisis. So I had an uncanny experience, which was when I handed the book in to my editor literally that week, I started reading these headlines that were coming across, and I thought to myself, I wrote that scene a year ago of the bankers heading down to the New York Fed. So I agree that the timing is odd, but it was entirely accidental.
You've got a scene of Henry Graves, the Fed chief in New York, and he's on the phone with a bank manager who's overextended, begging for a kind of bailout. He says he could just picture the guy, the double chin. This was the kind of business roundtable chump who spent his lunchtime decrying government intrusion and now found himself on a cell phone in the middle of the night pleading with the government to save him. We would soon enough, Adam, see that from the biggest banks on Wall Street.
Yeah, it's. I think for people who – Jack was just talking about Larry Summers in the 90s. I mean, for people who were following and paying attention to the world financial – global financial system in the last 15 years, they knew it was unstable. We'd had the Asian currency crisis. We'd had the Russian default. I mean, the idea that it was a precarious structure – was known, but it hadn't really come home to people until the fall of 2008.
And what about for you as a writer? I mean, Jack wishes that you felt more of the pain of people beyond. Maybe you were done writing by then. But what put your antenna up to the sort of morally suspect culture that was driving so much of the country's business?
Well, I think that to me, the financial industry is in a way a metaphor for a larger change in the relationship between business and government and everyday citizens and mm-hmm. media and everything else. And that was a set of changes that have been going on for quite a while. And as your first guest today talked about, for the last 15 years, Democrats have been as close to Wall Street as Republicans, and there's been a coziness at the top among political and financial elites. And so, in a way, you know, I think of the task is to portray the world I'm living in, and that world was already present.
And Jack, on the other side is poor Charlotte Graves, who, by her lights, has fought the good fight. And now she's with her dogs in her old house, a kitchen that looks like it's out of the grapes of wrath, Adam writes. And, you know, talking about a roar that drowned out the litany in her head, sort of this new era driving out everything she holds dear, sort of Henry II and the Magna Carta and Gutenberg and Calvin and Milton and Kant and Paine and Jefferson. And, you know, she's hearing all that being Walker Evans and Copeland and Baldwin and King in Memphis, and it's all being washed away.
It is, and she has to look down the hill and see this this pile, this house that, as she says, stands for a, quote, a rot more pervasive. So she sees the house. She also sees what it stands for. You know, a very interesting character. But again, here I had a problem because the moral, aesthetic, political critique that she's making of Doug's world seems to me to be precisely what progressives have been saying for the last decade. There isn't a jot of it that seems off or mad, and yet she's clearly bonkers. So I'm wondering, why make your critique, the person who really has the goods on this world,
sure,
nuts?
Well, I mean, you know, because I think that she's experiencing the failure of that worldview over the last 30 years to make a difference. I mean, the two Democratic presidents, the two sort of possible leaders for progressivism, one was Bill Clinton, and that was obviously an era of very cozy relations to Wall Street, and the other is Obama. And so I think, in a way, there's a decay of that tradition that she is embodying, and she's being kind of driven mad by the force of her ideas. In that sense, she and Doug actually have something in common. They're both absolutists. They're both people who believe without a shadow of a doubt that they're right.
What does Doug think of her view of the world, of her, you know, conviction and principles and, in a way, primness? I mean, he may think she's mad. You make her ultimately mad. But how does the go-get-em, no matter what it takes, banker see the old guard here?
Well, she, rather Doug, sees her in many ways rightly as a snob, as someone who looks down on someone who's trying to advance himself. And, you know, the other dynamic here is a kind of class one. I mean, his mother cleaned houses in the town of Findon, and he's now come back to build this house there. So he sees her as someone who's judging him and someone who has always enjoyed privilege. And he's angry. He's an angry character. And I think two of the main forces that we've been living with in the last 10 years in this country are kind of militarism and a hyper-capitalism. And I think that anger is, in a way, the emotion that vivifies both of those forces.
Militarism and hyper-capitalism. Peter in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air with Adam Hazlett.
Oh, hello. Well, it appears I'm half a topic behind on the one hand, but I just wanted to make a point of this notion of Wall Street sort of turning against Obama. It definitely seems to me it's disheartening and ironic in equal amounts. It seems, what have you done for me lately? The administration has obviously taken a lot of heat for all that they have done for Wall Street in terms of saving investment firms, and certainly, you know, it appears a year later saving multi-million dollar bonuses. So it just definitely, with all that you folks are talking about, definitely disheartening to see that they have such a short memory.
And nothing apologetic about it, either in the news that we heard from David Kirkpatrick or in your novel, Adam Hazlett. There's no apologizing here. There's forward we go.
Yeah, I mean, I think to speak to what the caller just said, there was a moment, it seems to me at least, in the spring of 2009 where we were really in the trough of the recession and the country was in shock, and there was a willingness, I think, and a populist anger that obviously came out in Massachusetts later, that Obama could have pivoted in a more progressive direction. And he's now come around to a more populist position on finance. But I think that was that seemed like an opportunity missed.
Let's go to Niagara Falls, New York, and Mark. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Mark. You're on.
Oh, hi. I'm a capitalist, and the invisible hand, as Adam Smith, the invisible hand of the economy can do whatever it wants as long as it doesn't pick my pocket, but it has. And so I want my money back with interest, and I want regulations to see that it doesn't happen again. I would take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Mark. The straight payback, not enough. Mark wants the regulation, but it's not an attitude that you portray in this novel of an industry that's likely to stand still for that harness, Adam.
No, I mean, I think the interesting thing about what the caller is talking about is that we do have this sense that there should be a pretty firm line between government and business. And one of the things that I was fascinated by was that the Federal Reserve is in a way an organization that is very close to the industry that it regulates, and a lot of people would say is sort of captured by that industry. So someone like the head of the New York Fed, who's one of my main characters here, is the guy that finds himself in the position of being responsible for preventing a meltdown. And on the other hand, in order to prevent it, he has to endorse after the fact, if not endorse, at least clean up the malfeasance at these organizations. And that situation hasn't changed. I mean, even after the crisis, the banks that were too big to fail are now bigger than they were before the crisis. So we are now, in a sense, in a situation even more perilous than we were before.
Jack, Adam Hazlett puts that picture of the Federal Reserve Bank's extreme intimacy with the banking industry and the bankers in it really front and center here. The midnight phone calls, things have gone wrong, hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, are needed and not around. They need kind of quiet bailouts in the story in Union Atlantic. But it's just, you know, guys talking. They may not even like each other, but it's the whole picture of financial stability is portrayed here as a kind of pretty picture that's put up for us while all the quiet, sometimes dirty work goes on behind the scenes.
Yes, and, you know, it tracks pretty well some of the reporting that that the New York Times did last year on Timothy Geithner at the New York Fed, who again and again made decisions now being questioned. Some were sound, some weren't. But the point was, it was the intimacy. It was how often he talked on the phone to these people. It was the way some of these bankers talked about him. And they spoke of him, you know, the way a parent does of a promising little leaguer. You know, he's showing he's good. He gets to the plate. He does what he's told. He's fine. It was chilling. And the chilling part, to me, the profoundly chilling part, is that Barack Obama saw fit to make this man, who, talk about regulatory capture, who seemed captured, you know, bound and gagged, Secretary of Treasury.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Adam Hazlett. He's the author of the new novel Union Atlantic. It's being described as the first big novel about our turn of the century, Wall Street, skullduggery. This is not Theodore Dreiser. This is not Steinbeck. This is not Tom Wolfe. This is right here, right now, in our era, the era of our collapses and failings. Adam Hazlett joins us from New York. Let's take a call right now from Norfolk, Virginia. Joe, you're on the air. Hi, Joe. You're on.
Oh, that was quick. Thank you very much.
What do you think, Joe?
Hello.
Hello, Joe. Yeah. What do you think?
I have heard a lot of these radio financial advisors and political commentators say that one of the reasons that derivatives and some of the other sophisticated financial instruments were developed in the first place was to dance around the regulations that were in place at the time so that they could get out of those regulations and present new kinds of financial dealings and go on their merry way. Now, if the government is to regulate what's happened up to now, what's to stop bankers to come up with new kinds of instruments and do the same thing again?
Joe, thanks. I mean, it's not so clear yet exactly what kind of regulation we are going to have coming out of this. But, Adam, what about the sensibility of bankers that you're portraying here? It doesn't seem like one that's going to sit back and just calmly play within a new rule book, even if one is published.
No, I mean, I think that's the larger picture here and the way in which finance is just one industry among many where the rules and assumptions about how you act have changed, and there's a cutthroat save yourself attitude out there in the world at large that, you know, a lot of it comes from a sense of economic insecurity and scarcity. I mean, even from some of the wealthiest people who can imagine themselves on the verge of being impoverished, like these bankers who are worried they're not going to get their bonuses.
They're super millions. You've got a reading where even the bankers are kind of wondering about what's going on here, where young Doug Fanning, who's elsewhere in the book, just sort of a guided missile. I mean, if there's money, he's headed toward it. But here he's talking again with his boss in the Union Atlantic Bank about what's falling away and what it leaves behind. I wonder if you could read a little bit for us there, Adam.
Sure. This is when Union Atlantic's beginning to get into trouble and they're having to decide how to move forward and cover their trail in a sense. And they're in Jeffrey Holland's study. Doug took down from the shelf a vintage leather-bound edition of De Gaulle's memoirs, only to find that the pages remained uncut. "You know what I've been thinking lately," he said. "I shudder to think," Holland said. "I've been thinking about how things are changing, the old compact between government, companies, the news, the basic assumptions about how everyone behaves. Most people have some vague sense of it. They feel a kind of undertow and they're scared by it. But they don't see how fundamental the shift is. They don't see it because they're too busy surviving or lamenting whichever piece of the old assurances they happen to be losing. So they get sentimental, wishing the tide wouldn't come in. At least that's what the losers do. You can do that. Or you can admit what you've always been up to, and then you can focus on the bigger picture." "And what might that be?" Holland asked. "Influence," Doug said. "Power over information, control, something bigger than rules or good taste, the more permanent instincts. You know what I'm talking about. You even get off on it. It's just the appearance of it that bothers you." "You're a piece of work. You really are," Holland said. "You think you get all this for free?" Doug said, gesturing at the paintings and the antique furniture. "Who the hell do you think you are? Free? I was making loans before you were born." "Sure. And every year the interest rate got better, didn't it? Government caps came off, and you could charge 25% on Joe Sixpack's credit card and get him to pay you for the privilege of keeping his money." "What are you, some kind of socialist now?" Holland asked. "I'm nothing," Doug said. "I'm just saying, you take the advantages you take. That's how you got what you have." "Yeah," Holland said, "with one difference. It was legal."
Adam Hazlett reading from Union Atlantic. And Jack, there we are. He puts this kind of the lion's den, the masters of the universe, still with their braces they're on, and the more permanent instincts at work.
Yes, and at another point, Doug flatters himself that he is a, quote, master of the conditions that others merely suffered. Ooh. And, of course, those conditions are conditions that he helped create, as we know today. You know, you mentioned the Gilded Age, Tom, the squalid period of public corruption by business after the Civil War, the destruction of labor, massive violence against labor, and so on. And yet, in 50 years, in really less time. The economy went from being agrarian to industrial. The United States went from being a kind of international second-rate player to being a world power. Steel, oil, railroads, these were the sinews of American prosperity. And so for all the sordid realities of the Gilded Age, there was undoubted economic progress. Not so for our Gilded Age. We have just come through a decade Paul Krugman recently called the zero decade. Zero gains in real income for average families. Now we're knowing zero gains even in real estate values as that collapses. And as Paul Volcker recently said, zero added to the economy by all of Wall Street's pyrotechnics, except that they created a big blaze at the end.
Adam, if I could jump in, Tom, yeah. I mean, you asked earlier, you know, what could fiction tell us about all this? Because obviously we've had in the last year a lot of reports about the facts themselves and people digging into what happened. It seems to me that the role of a novel in this kind of situation is to take people into the deeper level, what's behind the facts, why, what sort of human emotions drive people at any given moment to act in a frightened way, in an angry way, and also how people stand back and feel as if they've been their lives and savings and everything have been taken from them. There's more to the situation we're in than the daily news reports, and I guess I'm trying to get at those conflicts that set the stage for where we are now.
You get into the sort of human condition and who will do what given the circumstances. We've got a comment here from Kenneth on Facebook who says, blame Wall Street, of course, but perhaps Wall Street is merely the most obvious symptom of the dark side of human nature. Which of us, like John Kerry, can say unequivocally that placed in the same position with money flowing like water and lots of places to hide and excuse bad behavior, we wouldn't do the same? What's Union Atlantic tell us about that?
Well,
fear.
I would agree with that comment. I mean, my goal here is not. I mean, maybe despite what we've sort of talked about so far, it's not really to set up a good evil distinction. I don't think of Charlotte as good and Doug as evil. In the end, hopefully, by the time the reader gets to the end of the book, they understand that Doug doesn't really know himself very well and comes to see things differently, even if he can't, in the end, be redeemed. I do think it's complex, and I do think it's easy to now simply take one group of people and say all of our problems lie there. It is a larger cultural sort of forgetting that's going on, and that's one of the things that Charlotte's tracking.
You don't give us anyone who's perfect here, but if Charlotte's not good and he's not evil, then is there a good in evil?
I don't think a good novel portrays good and evil. I mean, I think that's more Hollywood's realm in a sense.
I feel a little unmoored in that case, Jack. I mean, maybe that's just the way it is, but I mean, he's a torpedo just going for the money, and he'll do anything to get it. She may be, as in this book, she's portrayed as nuts, but she does kind of lean on our whole tradition of deeper Western thinking and philosophy and moral structure, or tries to.
She certainly does, and she speaks for the old verities. But as Adam says, she's at the end of her tether because the old verities have played out in this world of where I think you use the phrase of money as sort of the bloodstream. Kind of. In other words, there's no denying it. It will triumph no matter what. And
well, in that. To take off from what Jack just said about the difference between the Gilded Age at the end of the 19th century and now, I mean, he's exactly right. Before the crash, 40% of our gross domestic product was finance, which is not the production of anything but financial products, i.e. transactions. So there was no real economy there. And when that bubble burst, we're not left with factories and companies and something that's going to lead us into a new century. And so there's a sense in which it was sort of an ersatz world we were living in for the last 10 years. And that has not only material consequences, but I think it has psychic consequences. We know we're being lied to. There's something there's something unreal about the prosperity we were seeing around us. And so I think a lot of us are now stepping back and thinking, what did we just experience?
Let's let our listeners in here. California, Malibu, California. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is a little outside the book. I haven't read it, but do you guys see a global footprint anywhere where things are being done in a manner that we should benchmark ourselves in this country or as human beings, I guess? I'm troubled by the subject. I think a lot of us out here are right now. We're confused by what takes place in these banks and the fact that 40% of our GNP is just off financial instruments and not off production. That's a scary thing. Is there somewhere out there in the world we can look and say, here's an institution or a country or a place that we should start benchmarking ourselves?
Boy, well, it's a plaintive question, but it resonates, Michael. Adam, what do you say?
Well, you know, I think there is now beginning to be something more of a global will among the industrialized nations to do something more powerful to regulate. I mean, what's happened thus far, what's happened over the last 25 years is that any one country that would regulate too much, the fear would always be, well, the money's just going to go somewhere else. You know, the money will go to London or the money will go to Singapore. So it has to be globally coordinated to prevent that. And the fact is we live in a world in which these companies are larger than any one government. So, I mean, obviously, Obama's got so many things on his plate. I mean, whether that coordination can happen, I don't know. But there's a will for it. And I think the fact that he's now leaning towards Volcker's advice suggests that. Volcker had an op-ed the other day in the Times saying that there was, in fact, an increasing global willingness to set a new benchmark.
Adam Hazlett, author of the new book Union Atlantic. There's quite a moment in the book where the head of the bank is in big trouble. They've their staff has been really breaking the rules out in Asia. They're way in a deep hole. They need the Fed's bailout. And Henry Graves, Charlotte's brother, who's head of the New York Fed, challenges the guy. He's trying to get through to the sort of a self-satisfied head of the bank. He says, what if we say no to him? What if I tell him you're an awfully bad bet and in the end the market will do its job and decide what you're really worth? And if that's a dollar a share, so be it. What then? And you've got Jeffrey Holland, the sort of big banker, and his political guile falls away. You're right. He levels at Henry a cold stare and finally says to him, come off it, Henry. I've spoken to Senator Grassley's people. I know what you're hearing from Treasury. So what's with the civics lesson? And you write, Adam, in his mouth, the phrase civics lesson sounded almost dirty. Jack, yeah. There's the other world, Jack. There's the unvarnished.
Oh, boy, that's the truth. Forgive me, Senator Grassley. But, you know, and, of course, these people are still on the scene, aren't they, making their moves.
Yeah, let's see if we can get a call from Charleston, South Carolina here. And Eleanor, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello. I'm just pulling over so I can visit with you. I've been trying for a while. I am a retired banker, and I think what's happening today is just a mushroom of what began back in the 60s. I work for a bank that went bankrupt without telling its employees, and we all lost our investments in the bank, our shares of stock, which were mandatory purchase of a 0.5% of your salary.
Wow.
And then I heard later on that all of the officers that were on the board got a $500,000 bonus before the bank closed.
So, Eleanor, do you see what we've just been through as same old, just more of the same, or something different in degree or in its quality?
I think what's happening is just mushroom there. Like I say, I dealt directly with the public. I had no input to the decisions that were made up in the hierarchy. But it seems as though the hierarchy can't relate to what's bringing them to the point that they're at to make these horrible decisions.
Eleanor, I appreciate your call. I'm glad you pulled over to make it. I mean, Adam, there's a voice. You have some similar voices, one in particular who ends up being the kind of truth teller who gets everything straightened out. It's just a mid-level official in the bank. Maybe Eleanor would have been that in her bank situation if she could have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that character is Evelyn Jones, who she's the one who's really in the mechanics and sees how it works. I think one of the things that it's difficult for most of us to do is to think about or be able to hold in our head at the same time all the complexities of the sort of the macro picture with individual lives. And that's what I was trying to do in the novel, is match those two things up. And so the caller's talking about being in touch with the public and then the guys up in the suites making the decisions. And I was trying to give the reader the opportunity, through being in the minds of all these characters, to, in a sense, slow down for a minute and try to see the whole and feel the whole as well, not just as intellectual matter, but a dramatic matter.
Jack, if fiction has a job, I guess that's it. And maybe nowhere more needed these days than in this very realm that Adam's begun to chip open.
It holds the mirror to life, and I think we see a lot here that can seem familiar and repulsive. And in fact, even worse, it's when we turn from the mirror to the reality of the 14 million unemployed that it looks even worse.
It's our country. We may glimpse our own faces in that mirror, Jack, one way or another. But Adam Hazlett, we're really grateful to you for your time today and for the new book. Well, it's Union Atlantic. Congratulations. Thank you very much for joining us, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us this hour, and have a great weekend, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.